Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel speeding in!
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Okay, hopefully that was all recorded, you know? A little pre-show hype. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim Jerome coming at you with yet another episode. We live and breathe for another week. We haven't been canceled. Of The Suspendables. With me and, of course, the one and only Russ Cortinel. I don't know what show we're into, Russ. I don't want to have to talk to our producer, Stevie. We're probably, we're getting close to 100. Okay.
I think we're around 90.
Maybe. Okay, there you go. Yeah, around 90 shows. Because the over-under when we started this, Russ, I remember you and I were talking about it, was about 31.
Well, I didn't tell anybody. I had family calling me up going, do you have a podcast? And I said, yeah, I didn't tell you in case it got canceled.
Yeah. How well is it going? How are we reaching the masses if our families don't know we have a podcast? Shows have been great. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We got a website, of course, thesuspendables.com, and all the episodes are on there. You can listen to them, and they're all great. We got a guest on today. So when Russ asked me to join him to do this podcast, he is one of the guys, Russ Cortinel, that people have said, I've been around him a lot. Rusty have known each other for over 20 years, where people would go, you know what, Russ? Because he's a great storyteller, as you all know by now. You should write a book, right? You should write a book. And because you got so many stories, right? And the problem with that was content was fine. There, it would be an endless book. It'd be War and Peace of stories. Is Russ doesn't know how to write, you see. So that was, but all the, you know, this show is synonymous with stories. We when we came on air originally, we said, we're not breaking hockey games down. It's going to be a bunch of stories off the page, sometimes out of bounds, sometimes way out of bounds and over the line, but people like it. So one of my buddies over the years is a guy who has decided to write a book. About stories in the NHL. He's the award-winning anchor on TSN. I'm talking about James Duthie, who's put a book together. And I said, I got to get him on, man, because my friend dropped this book off in my house called Beauties. And it's an unbelievable book. I know, Russ, you haven't had a chance yet to peruse it, but I have. And we've got him on today. James, how are you, brother?
Well, the only reason I came on is to get stories from both of you for the sequel. I'm just completely and utterly using both of you right now.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I almost nixed you. Okay. Duthie, I'm going to tell you why. Okay.
Because you're not in the book.
No. Well, that, okay. That,
and thank God.
Yeah. That one. Yeah. But yeah, well, I'm not in it. Cause you want to sell copies. You hit me with the tech. Hey, we're texting back and forth and you hit me with the bud. Okay. You gave me the bud.
Do you hate the bud text? Sorry, that's a bad habit of mine. I'm a big bud texter.
Yeah, well, that's why I feel so special, because everyone's bud, you know? anyway, James, great to have you on, man. Anyone in Canada for sure knows you, and you've been involved in the media game your whole life. You're from Ottawa. You got into it in college. One of your biggest achievements for sure would be, you know, the media game is a perilous at best sometimes, trying to survive, you know, and keep a job, really. If you're going to do it in this business, you got to be good. You got to be good. And you've been around a long time, man. Congratulations on an absolute storied career and all the things that you have done. I look forward, because I know are you doing the Masters this year as well?
That's a loaded question, Jimmy, and a sore point with me right now because, and by the way, thank you for those nice words. I just slept with a lot of people.
At a point.
Well done.
Yeah.
So the Masters is one, like, not to bore your listeners, but basically when we lost the national hockey rights a few years ago, one of the cool things for me is they let me do a bunch of other sports. So I do the Super Bowl and the Masters and the Grey Cup and a bunch of things. And the Masters is always one of my favorite weeks of the year. And this year, because of COVID and the truncated NHL season, Masters Sunday is the day before trade deadline, which your Canadian listeners is, you know, a massive deal here. I'm still not sure exactly why, but it is. And so I don't think that because of COVID and everything, I could probably get down there and get back, but I don't think I'll be able to because of the rules. So I think I'll probably have to do the Masters from here, which saddens me more than anyone probably ever knows. But I'll be covering it, but probably from studio, I think.
Tell us, James, before we talk about this book, how are you guys pulling off hockey games? What's happening with COVID? Because I know a bunch of I'm certainly curious when I see live broadcasts, for example, the Australian Open was just on, and although I assumed all those guys, the McEnroe brothers and all the commentators, were in Melbourne, but they're not. And it got me thinking, how are you guys doing hockey games, James?
Yeah, it's weird. There's normalcy for the most part. Like we'll do as I'm talking to you right now, we're doing a Leafs Flames game tonight. So, Gordon Miller and Ray Ferraro are on the game. Ray, I'm not sure about, cause I don't want to lie to our listeners. Like Ray does some of them from his home in Vancouver where he goes into the studio and watches it on a monitor. Gord, I believe, is in the building. Sometimes Ray is in Toronto in the building. It's sort of a crapshoot. But sometimes there was one night in the studio, we're there, but we've got a big studio, so they separate us. So I only can have one guy on the desk with me about 12 feet away. And then there's two other guys on a desk like 40 feet in the back. So it just kind of looks weird. And there was a night when Gord and Jamie McLennan and Noodles were in doing, I think, a Senators game, and they were in the same studio in a voice booth. So I could actually, they were 15 feet away from me calling the game. So I think you're right. Like, it's about 50-50 right now when you're watching a hockey game in Canada or the States, I think, as to whether the people are actually in the building or not, or whether they're in some other building and back in their home city doing play-by-play. I think it actually scares me that more people don't notice, because right. If you give corporations the idea that they can do this cheaper, I fear that that will be the future of hockey broadcasting, that wow. They will say, well, why are we going to send you if we can do it from here and nobody notices? Yeah. And that is a definite concern of mine, because I think the play-by-play guys are really good and they pull it off, but it's not the same as being in the building.
James, you know, I have to tell you guys are doing a great job. And I think from an amateur looking at what you guys are pulling off, but having played, there is still that connection on the day of a game from the announcers, play-by-play guys with the players, getting information, having conversations. And you couldn't do that remotely. I mean, I guess you could call guys, but there's still going to be that interaction. I think that really adds to the broadcast. But I have to say the hockey has been leading the way for sports. The entertainment value for the fans has been phenomenal through these crazy times that we're living through.
Yeah, I don't know what we would have done through this mess without sports. So we're all going nuts anyway. But if we didn't have any sports on, I think it's goofy. And I do applaud them all, not just hockey, for being able to, you know, I got my golf on weekends, and it's a lifesaver, frankly. But you know what you're saying there is interesting, Russ. Like for the reporters who cover the games, it's a lot more difficult, because the only interviews that they're doing are on Zoom, where the players mm-hmm. in a completely different place. I think the players, frankly, probably love this. They don't have the forms of media coming in.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's another thing that worries me is this, you know, are they going to say, hey, we can do this a little bit more going forward? Because even in the time that I've covered the game nationally, I think my first Stanley Cup final was maybe 05 or 06 for TSN. And those were still the days you could go in and sit down on the, you know, after practice during the cup final and sit down and talk to a guy for 10 minutes as he's taking off his gear. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't happen anymore, right? Basically now they bring out, you know, a handful of players a day. So it was already changing before COVID even happened. So I do worry again, when we come out of this, of how many of these things that they'll keep with, just to give the, and by the way, I never thought guys should necessarily be in the dressing room. I was one who thought, The dressing room should be for players, but man, bring everybody out, you know, have a little area outside. Everybody's got to come out for 5 minutes or whatever so you can talk to them. But I have no problem if they kick us out of dressing rooms. It's just, you do want to have those face-to-face conversations once in a while.
What are the radio guys doing? Is anybody, if they go on the road, like Bonesy there and Ralphie, who do the Leafs broadcast, right.
I don't know with those two, but I think a lot of them are doing the broadcasts from, like, they'll do the road broadcasts from their home building. They'll just go up. There's a lot of broadcasts happening in empty, dark buildings.
That's weird.
Where the radio or TV guys are in their home building doing the watching on TV, calling the game on the road. I don't know for a fact on Bonesy and Ralphie if they're traveling or not, but I think that around the league, there's an awful lot of guys that are not traveling and only doing home games live.
Wow. Do you think the league's going to be able to continue to pull this off? I mean, they did it in the first bubble last year, and it was incredible that they were able to do it. What are your thoughts there, James, about, you know, looking ahead? Are they going to be able to put the season to bed?
I think we're all chasing the vaccine here, Jimmy, like anything else. And right. It's going a lot better in the States than it is in Canada right now, although it's starting to finally pick up in Canada. I think they're going to play dodgeball the entire season. I'm not sure that they're going to get in 56 games for everybody. Mm-hmm. If you look at what's happened already in the American divisions, and the Canadian division's been able to dodge it so far, but I have a feeling that, you know, if you're 10 games behind or 12 games behind, they're not going to be able to make that up, and they might have to do a situation where the North division plays a full 56, but a couple of the American divisions maybe only play 46, and it doesn't really matter. I guess it matters for stats and for trophies and such, but as long as everybody in the same division plays the same, you're okay. And I don't know, you guys know better than me whether there'll be an advantage.
Don't say that.
Okay, Russ, anyway. Whether there's an advantage to teams who have played less games. But I have a hard time believing everybody's going to get in 56 games.
Yeah, I think so too. And the book is called Beauties, and it's really good. Let me just read a couple of things about it. Duthie loves to hear and loves to tell stories, a great hockey story. This book is full of them. Most will make you laugh. A few might make you cry. You know how we always say, that guy's a beauty. I've heard that my whole life. You know, Jerome's a beauty, right? It just means you're an idiot, okay, when they said it about me. And this book is full of beauties. There's 57 incredible stories, as it says, from hockey's biggest names, greatest characters, you know, and unsung heroes, including stories about a million different guys. It's a fantastic book, James. I haven't got through all of them, but I've read most of the stories. First of all, how did you pull it off, this book? Because when you do dive into these stories, it's like, oh my God, you know, celebrities, hockey players are the toughest guys to nail down, okay, to do an interview. Or it's a great idea, and we all know great ideas are fine until it comes time to pull it off, but you really did.
No, thank you. I'm not blowing smoke, but I did it because of guys like you, because of characters like you guys, and what you do on this podcast and what you've done your whole careers is tell stories, right? And I think that all my years, I've been sitting on that panel on TSN for almost 20 years now.
Wow.
That's amazing. you get this long path of, you know, we sort of have permanent guys now, the Mike Johnsons and Dave Poulins and, you know, Bob McKenzie's not with us as much this year, Jeff O'Neill. But for, you know, we've had so many ex-coaches come in and they come in for a year. Or players come in during the playoffs. I've probably had 100 different guys sitting next to me. And the favorite part of the gig is just listening to them most of the time, not on camera, but while we're in commercial breaks or before the shows, when we're sitting around eating pizza, right. Just tell those great stories. Right. And I think that you guys would probably agree with this, that hockey lends itself to those stories more than other sports for whatever reason. Right. There's something about the grit and dirtiness of hockey that just, you know, guys who they can call hockey players boring in those intermission interviews when it's all about get pucks deep. But if you get them having a couple of beers, every player's got, you know, some great stories. And I guess somewhere along the way, Jimmy, maybe 5 years ago, I started to think, I'd written a couple of books already, but never one like this. And I said, could I just do a book that's not an autobiography, you know, where you have to go through the whole, oh, I grew up in rural Saskatchewan, all that right. bullshit. And you just, it's just stories. So I basically just called guys and said, tell me your favorite hockey story that's maybe not out there. And it can be anything. I don't care if it's a crazy ass game or something that happened in the bar after the game or some wacky teammate. Just tell me the first story. Like if I sat down with Russ and Jungle in a bar and I said, Russ, tell me your favorite story. That's basically what I wanted the book to be.
Very cool. Hockey players love hearing stories and we love telling stories. And when you're around a bunch of hockey players, and especially you mix in a couple cocktails, you know, somebody will tell a story and then it reminds somebody of something they've forgotten and they relive the story. And
I spent right.
summers at Gaza Ranch and Gretz is there and Brett Hull and Kelly Chase and Ray Whitney and on, Sheldon Surrey. There's a bunch of us, Brendan Morrow, Guy Carboneau, and we sit around this little tree bar and people love hearing these stories and it's just epic. And so do we. And I think one of the reasons that a lot of us play golf after we're retired is because we miss that. We miss that.
Right.
I remember when I was 18, 19, 20 in Toronto and the older guys would go, okay, meet me in the hot tub. I want to hear what you guys did last night. Tell me the story. Like,
yeah.
Get in there.
And, you know, it's kind of dying too, Russ. Like it's yeah. a bit of a, the way that hockey is today, where the kids sit around the rooms and play video games, you yeah. know, I wonder if the next generation will have them as much. Although I was pretty happy. Like when I went to, you know, the Connor McDavids and the Crosbys, Austin Matthews for the book, I was pretty happy with the stories they had. Cause you know, they're not the most, a guy like Connor or Sid, they're not the most exciting interviews, but if you get them again in that environment and they trust you a little bit, mm-hmm. I have had a good relationship with Sid for a long time. Sid was fascinating because he would send me, you know, I was trying to write this book in the middle of a playoff race last year, and it's hard to get a hold of guys for an hour or two. Hey, can I have 2 hours of your time to try to suck some stories out of you? So what Sid would do was send me voice memos. Ah. So it was the weirdest thing. Like every week I get this, a text pop up and it would be a voice memo from Sid. I don't know if he's sitting in his hotel room somewhere and he'd be like, oh yeah, I just came up with another one. And he'd tell me some story and they were good, like good stories. So I guess there's hope for this generation that there'll be, I could do beauties 2 or 3 or whatever, and they'll all have them at some point, but just not as good as your generation stories.
I want to read the book you can't write.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, the Jeff O'Neill himself, like doing his chapter, I had an entire book of stories I couldn't put in the book.
Well, two beauties I know are Mark Bergevin and my brother Jeff, who are the ultimate pranksters. I don't know if they right. made your book or not, but they are freaking hilarious.
Bergevin did get in, and by the way, that was the other thing, and I really mean this. I'd love to, if I do a sequel, which the publisher's bugging me, but it's a lot to wrap your head around writing a book. It's such a pain in the ass, and so I'm trying to contemplate right now, but I'd love to have both you guys in it because there was no, like, it's not like I made a, yeah, you know, I said I wanted Gretzky and Crosby and McDavid and a few guys like this, Bobby Orr. But after that, I really just, it was kind of like first come, first serve, whoever I thought of, right? Like I called Chaser and Chaser tells me some and Chaser says, here, call Jimmy McKenzie. And Jimmy McKenzie says, call Garth Butcher. And
yeah.
And that's basically all I did. And when I got up to 50, I had enough stories. So it's not like I made a list of the 50 greatest storytellers in the league or whatever. It was just, it was completely haphazard of who That's I got great. In the book after the big names.
Jeff, sorry, Jim, I just want to tell this one story.
Jump in. Yeah.
So Jeff was trying to get a hold of Bergie. And obviously it's the GM of Montreal and Bergie's not returning Jeff's calls and Jeff's getting pissed off. And they're very close friends. The one true great friend that Jeff probably has from hockey is Bergie. So
and they played together, right?
Yeah, they played together and they screwed with one another every day. And then they started getting other guys. I mean, the stories are, you could do one book between the two. You could do a book of Bergie and a book of Jeff of all the crazy shit they did. But Jeff finally got pissed off and he leaves Bergie a voicemail and says, hey, I really need to talk to you. I'm on chapter six, and I just want to clarify this one story I'm writing about you. And you better freaking call me back, because I'm just going to make it up and finish it off. And I got to move on to chapter seven first. You picked up the phone. What book? What book? What book are you writing?
Well, it's funny. Bergie's in the book, but not... I ended up doing a chapter on agents just because I figured, A, agents had good stories, and B, sometimes I had to use the agents to get to the players. So agents have enough ego that if you tell them, hey, can you get me this guy? I'll put a story of yours in the book, too.
Yeah.
So, but Pat Brisson... decided to tell a Bergie story in the book. And it was basically about, remember that tour in the first big lockout in, I guess it was 05-06 when they went to Europe. Yeah. So they put this little all-star team of their clients together and go and play in Europe. And they picked Bergie just for the entertainment. They didn't want him to play because he was at the end of his career. They just wanted him to coach. And Bergie showed up every single game. He came in with a different costume on. So like one night, this is a coach. One night he's like a pirate, and one night he's whatever. One night they brought him in. So a hockey bag, they brought in a hockey bag, the trainers, and just threw it in the middle of the room. And then the players, it's about to go on the ice, and they're like, where's Bergie? And they unzip the hockey bag, and he's in there in his underwear. And he stands up and does the pregame speech. So everything that you said is echoed by a bunch of other people that I spoke to.
Yeah, I had an ulterior motive bringing you on too, because some of the great stories of hockey are what's happened to media guys, you know, during broadcasts or whatever, or interviews. One of my favorites is Gary Galley. I did that radio show in Ottawa with Stevie for 12 years, and Gary Galley had first started and was doing a show, doing the afternoon show or something at TSN in Ottawa. And it got to this lively call in from a bunch of people freaking out about the Sens, saying they got to get rid of these guys and trade and all that. And Galley was trying to be, you know, he's like, well, maybe they do, you know, maybe not. And he was sitting on the fence. Anyway, they go to commercial, and Galley thinks he's pushed his mute button, but they're still on air. And he starts, I know what they gotta effing do. They gotta get rid of Hossa, they gotta get rid of Bonk, and dropping the f-bombs and the m-effers and everything all the way. Like I said, Dutty must have a million stories, but Rusty, you gotta tell him, tell James and the listeners about you pretending, we did it many, many shows ago, but you pretending you were Luc Robitaille?
Oh, God. So Luc is about to surpass. He's scoring all these goals, and he was about to pass somebody. So they finally get – I'm playing for the Kings, obviously, and our media guy finally gets some big guy from the LA Times or something down, Sports Illustrated, to finally come to the locker room. Like, you know, in Toronto, you're trying to keep guys, reporters out. In LA, you're trying to get people down to actually talk to the players. And so I would always get people asking me, hey, Luc, can I have your autograph? Hey, Luc. And we looked a lot alike. He's taller, and we have same hair and all that stuff. So I can see people confusing us, but this guy goes, hey, Luc, do you got time to do this this interview? And I go, yeah, sure. And I sit down, and it's after practice, and he starts asking me questions, and I start answering, well, I'm the greatest player, you know, that's ever played the position. I can't believe it took me this long to pass him, and I'm the best French Canadian player to ever come out. And this guy is like writing everything down,
lighting up.
I'm spitting, laughing. I'm laughing. This guy is taking it all in, writing it all down. He's recording it. And I do the interview for about 10 minutes. And as I'm leaving, the media guy, Mike Altieri, walks by, and he goes, I go, Mike, I just did the Luc Robitaille interview. He goes, you didn't. He had to go run down, catch the guy, and go, that was a player playing a joke on you. Can you please come back here? The guy was so pissed off. He had spent 10 minutes, and I couldn't stop laughing and giving him all this bullshit that I was the best.
It's just too bad that never made to press. Robitaille, hockey's cockiest athletes.
Yeah.
What How about you, James? Come on. We need some embarrassing, and then I want to talk about a few stories in the book.
One of my most embarrassing stories is literally my very first week on the job as a sportscaster, Jimmy. I started in Ottawa and at what was called CJOH TV. It's CTV Ottawa now.
Sure.
And that it was, I was a news reporter for a bunch of years covering murders and politics, because back then there weren't that many jobs in sports. And so finally they started to, I think I was 22 or 23. They finally gave me a few chances to do sportscasts, and I was terrified. And the first week, I think it was like my third night doing them, I was doing the 11:30 sportscast, and my microphone fell off my lapel into my lap. And I was in the middle of doing a bunch of baseball highlights. And I didn't know what, like, if that happened to me today, I would just, pause for a second, reach right down, put my microphone back on, calmly as could be. But back then I was so terrified, I didn't know what to do. So I froze and I just kept talking. And the director is talking in my ear saying, your mic fell. And I'm just not listening. I'm just please get me through these highlights. So I just keep going. So the floor director was this guy named Paul, and sort of, you know, French Gatineau 1992, big like white afro. And yeah, he had to climb underneath the desk to nice try and reattach my microphone. So I am now kind of aware of this. He climbs underneath the desk and he's trying to grab my mic and reattach it to my lapel. And the highlights were still going on, but they had to end at some point. They had to come back to me on camera. And I don't want to exaggerate this. It wasn't 10 seconds or anything. It was probably a second and a half to 2 seconds. Right. But they cut back to me on camera, and all you could see was the top of this man's head right between my legs, like bobbing up and down. But, and if that, you imagine if that was like, you know, in the Twitter world today, I would have been probably, you know, would have been everywhere, but that stuff didn't exist back then. So I survived. But that was my baptism to the business. And I've had, you know, I don't think I've ever misidentified a guy, but I've had moments on trade deadline, which is, you know, a 12-hour show you're hosting and your mind is kind of fried, where I've forgotten in the middle of interviews who I was interviewing and literally yeah have gone generic and so, and be like, or forgotten where they've been traded to. And so, you know, you as a broadcaster, you learn how to cover. So I'll be like, so what are you looking forward to in your new city? Yeah. Like, you know,
awesome.
Yeah, yeah, just the worst.
I did an interview with Killer. Brian Kilray, who everybody knows, including Russ, one of Russ's all-time favorite coaches. We brought him when I first started. It was Ottawa Sports Radio. And he came on, and I knew Brian a little bit. And I completely, I didn't get quite get fired from it, but it was so stupid. So he did all this, and he's the winningest coach of all time, apparently. Okay, when you add up all his wins, like he beats everyone, the NHL, all these guys.
Yeah.
And I didn't remember that he was actually had about a 6-minute stop in the NHL with the Islanders. Mm-hmm. And I said, you're so good, man. Why don't you take a stab at coaching in the NHL? Oh,
no. Jim, I already have. Don't you do your research?
Yeah, exactly. And anyway, you know, some of the stories in this book, James, are you know, it says that, you know, there's tons of funny shit in there. It's really good. The names are big. Three of my favorites, cause he's a good friend of Rusty's and a well-deserving guy, John Cooper, you know, with Tampa and now a Stanley Cup champion. And what a wild story that was about him,
right?
And his goalie getting, I forget yeah if he's in the American League or whatever. Tell us about that.
You know, people ask me my favorite story in the book, and I, you know, it's like picking your favorite kid, which I have one, but I can't say it publicly. but I'm really not sure, but that I'll tell you that story when John, with a lot of guys, I just, you know, Coop's a friend of mine too. And so I said, hey, I'm doing this book. Do you have a story? And, you know, I want a story that hasn't been told that much. And so he said, yeah, I got one for you. And we arranged to talk. So I have no idea what it is when we start talking.
Right.
And when he started telling me the story, and, you know, for your listeners, I won't tell the whole thing, but basically it involves when he's coaching Syracuse in the minors, it involves a carjacking involving his goalie, a police chase, them arriving to a game late, a brawl, including a goalie brawl and one of the craziest comebacks in hockey history. And when he finished telling me the story, I literally said, Coop, this is the exact reason I wrote this book for stories like that. Like it basically encapsulates everything I wanted in the book in one story. And I know Coop's writing his own book right now, which is going to be fantastic.
Oh, good. I'll tell you how incredible that story is. When I read it, I said, you know, reading this thing, I said, I don't believe this. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't fucking believe that this happened. Excuse my language. Mm-hmm. I just have, and yet of course it's true. It's one of the most outrageous, incredible things I've ever heard.
Well, it's funny that you say that because that was a big challenge in writing this book. You know, hockey stories are like fish stories. They get exaggerated. There's broken telephone and, you know, you never know what's true or what's not true. And I actually write this in the postscript for the book. I used to hear when I was in Ottawa, the story about Gordie Howe, that Gordie once went to some corporate event and, you know, that wasn't a hockey crowd, but they paid him to go to this event. And so a lot of the people didn't know who he was. And so they had name tags at the front and they said, what do you want in your name tag? And he just wrote Mr. Hockey, right? So he's circulating the crowd and there's a group of people there and there's this woman who doesn't know who he is and says, oh, what's your name? Mr. Hockey, that's an interesting name. And what's your first name? And he says, Gordie. And she goes, oh, okay, everybody, this is Gordie Hockey. And so that's a story that I heard a bunch of different times from like four different people. So I told that story at some luncheon that Gordie was in attendance, some NHLPA luncheon I hosted. And Gordie was sitting there laughing and nodding appropriately, right? And everyone was laughing. And I sat down back next to him after, and I kind of leaned over and I said, Gordie, I've always wondered, is that story true? And he leans over to me and he goes, not a word, but I enjoyed it.
So, that's great.
So the point is that when I sat down to write this book, I didn't want bullshit. You know what I mean? I know there's going to be exaggeration and that's fine. And we need, you know, a little bit of great exaggeration is what every story needs. But I wanted the facts of the stories to be true. Because I'm sure you guys both know guys that, I know guys that I work with that BS stories that aren't true half the time when you fact check them. So, you know, with Coop's story, I thought the same thing, Jimmy. I said, did this really happen? And right. So, and he sent me the score sheet the next day that, you know, the crime report or whatever on the carjacking. So right. That was one of the jobs though, in the book is that I always had to, I wanted to check to make sure that it happened, right? To make sure that the scores were right. The dates were right. You know, the right people were on the right teams and, you know, I couldn't prove everything 100%, but for the most part, I didn't want any chapters in there that were pure BS that somebody could come after me afterwards and say this never happened.
Right. You know, there's 57 stories, man, in the book, right? So even if we do, mm-hmm. What happened here, of course, is this goalie gets robbed, Russ, okay? On the way.
Want people to buy the book, Jimmy.
No, they'll buy the book.
No, it's good. Okay. I don't care. It's
yeah, imagine how good all the other stories are, okay?
Yeah.
So it's incredible. But the other thing about the book that I really love is I just assumed that when you're going to pick up a book and it's going to be a bunch of hockey stories from guys, because I know your relationship with guys. So right away, that's a hook because you know all these guys personally, is I said, this is just going to be one of these freaking feel good things where all these things are all fairy tales and they're going to end up, you know, all sugar and we all love each other. Right. Not the case, man. Not the case with this book. The Darcy Tucker story with Pat Quinn, who is one of Russ. He's one of your favorite guys, isn't he, Russ?
Pat Quinn. Yeah. Yeah.
This thing doesn't end well.
Yeah. I mean, it's fairly harmless, but, and you're right, Jimmy, thanks for saying that. I wanted to make sure it was like that. Not all a little happy, happy, happy. Yeah. And, you know, Tucker, he idolized Pat Quinn. He's his favorite coach he ever had, but Tucker screwed up in a game. Everybody remembers, or at least sends the Leafs fans, the whole rivalry between Alfredson and Tucker, and Alfredson nailed Tucker in that playoff series. And, Tucker never forgot, as Tucker does, and basically was biding his time for a year and a half to get even. I think it was the first game of the season, and he'd been, you know, this had been building up inside of him, and Darcy went to get even and took a bad penalty at a bad time in the game, and Quinn pulled him into his office after the game, and basically, you know, the trainer comes in and says Pat wants to see you in his office, and Darcy walks in, and Pat's got the stogie going, and he's got a bottle of scotch out. I think it was scotch.
Yeah.
And says, you want a drink, and pours Darcy a drink, and they sit there and chat for a minute, and quietly, and Pat, Pat takes a couple of puffs on the stogie, and they talk about things and life for a second and their families. And then he's like, that penalty you took. and Darcy's like, yeah, that was a mistake or whatever. But, I really wanted to get even with Alfie or whatever. And Quinn said, when I was playing, I can't remember who, somebody got me, and I waited 8 years to get back at him. And what you did, I'll spare the expletives, but that was a selfish mofo blah, blah, blah move, and screamed at him basically and said, finish your drink and get the hell out of my office.
Yeah, beautiful.
I just, I just don't think that stuff happens in hockey anymore. Right. With the coach, with the bottle of scotch and calling in his player and then just giving him crap. And Darcy walked out of there like he was 2 feet tall. My other, on a similar note, Jamie McLennan Noodles is one of the great storytellers of the guys that I work with. And
right.
There's a couple of fantastic Noodles stories in the book, but Daryl Sutter, when Noodles was his, Noodles was the backup in Calgary for, who was the great Finnish goalie in Calgary? Sorry. I'm having a break.
Kiprasov.
Thank you. Sorry.
So nice one, Russ. Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, Noodles, Daryl was the coach, and Noodles comes in off the bench one night after Kipper got pulled. Actually, I don't even think it was Kipper. It was somebody else. I'm now butchering my own story in the book. I got to read the book again. It wasn't Kipper. It was whoever was preceded Kipper in Calgary. So anyway, the bottom line is Noodles comes in off the bench, and somebody scores on him on the second shot, just a bad greasy goal. And he pulls Noodles back out and puts the other guy back in. So next day, Noodles comes in, and Jimmy Playfair is the assistant and says, Coach D wants to see you in his office. So Noodles figures it's not good. So Noodles walks into his office, and Daryl's got this whiteboard out, and he's written all this stuff beside it, like in the room and preparation and fitness. And he's going to give Noodles a report card. And so he says, sit down, Noodles. He says, all right, your game preparation, what would you give yourself a grade? A to F or whatever. And Noodles goes, well, I think I'm pretty good. I give myself a B. And he goes, you know what? You're right. I'm going to give you a B as well. And then he's like, in the room, how are you with the guys? And he goes, well, I think I'm pretty popular. I try to keep the guys light. One of my rules is a backup goalie. And he goes, you're right, A minus. He writes it. So they go through about four or five things here. And Noodles is saying, hey, I'm doing pretty good here. I'm doing better than I did in high school.
Right.
And then he goes, what about coming off the bench cold? And Noodle starts to talk. And before he can finish the sentence, Daryl starts screaming, F, fucking F, 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 fucking F, get the fuck out of my room. And Noodle slides out of the room. And I just love coaches who pull stuff like that.
The story that that really got me too, and I read a bunch of them. I forget who the coach was, but he's got everyone on the ice, and he starts to skate for all these guys.
Milbury. Yeah,
you got to tell that. You got to tell that.
Yeah, it was Milbury in Boston, and again, this is another one that I couldn't believe was not in another book yet, but. This is one I'd heard from several players through the years, but Pooley was one of the guys there. Dave Poulin, he'd been traded from Philadelphia to Boston, and the Bruins were a really good team that year, but had lost a couple of games badly, and they were on their way to Vancouver, where they were going to have 2 or 3 days off before a game. Players were all looking forward to it. So they get off the plane. Milbury says, I want to see you tomorrow at 10 a.m. at the rink. And so the players are like, oh, we're going to get bag skated like hell.
Right.
So they show up at the rink and get their stuff on and get on the ice. And Milbury says, line up along the end boards. So they figure they're going to get just suicides, right?
Right.
Complete bag skate. Milbury says, I could work the hell out of you today, guys, but I'm not going to do that. I don't think that, conditioning's the problem. Your problem is up here. So today I'm going to skate for you. So he goes to every single player. And he's like, Dave Poulin, captain of the Philadelphia Flyers. We were so excited when we got you, but some nights your head is just in Philadelphia. So I'm going to do two for you. And he skates up and down the ice, sprints twice. And he goes through every single player and does the suicides himself.
Yeah.
And the guys are like, like they thought he was going to die of a heart attack. This goes on for an hour and he's dying. And even the get, I guess it was, I think it was Craig Janney. Russ, you'd know better. Like Craig Janney wasn't known for his conditioning, right?
No.
Yeah. So great I think he gets to Craig Janney and he goes, all right, Craig Janney, you know, you have so much talent, terrific hockey player, but you are one of the worst conditioned athletes I've ever seen. So I am not skating for you. And he just goes on to the next guy. And awesome. And they all, you know, Janney was, they said, was about to cry. And finally they get to Ray Bourque. And he's like, Ray Bourque, one of the top, I played with number four, the best defenseman ever. And you're probably, you're definitely on the first hand. You know, you're one, you're two, three, four, somewhere on that first hand. But you still want to throw that puck up the middle of the ice. Ray, giveaway. I'm skating twice for you. And so basically they thought he was going to have a heart attack and he yelled at the guys and then did the ups and backs for them. And Pulley said it was brilliant, you know, because it made them all kind of think and feel a little bit guilty. And I think they went out the next couple of nights later and beat Vancouver like 7-1.
Yeah, that's funny.
Awesome.
I was playing golf a while ago with a guy from Florida. Yeah, shocker. And he talking about hockey stories. He said, "I'm really good friends with Jimmy Buffett." And he goes, "If you listen, we're listening to music while we're playing." He goes, "Put on Boat Drinks," and he wrote this song after hanging out with the Boston Bruins. He was out at. Was it Delilah's or some? Derek Sanderson owned a bar then in Boston, and he drank all night with hockey players, and he was so freaking hammered. Jimmy leaves the bar, and there was a cab running, and there was no cab driver in it, so he freaking stole the cab, drove it back to his hotel. Left it running in front of the hotel, and he wakes up in the morning to knock, 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 and it's two police officers, and they said, "Mr. Buffett, did you take that cab that's running downstairs?" And he goes, "Yeah, I did. There was no driver in it, so I took it." And they said, "Well, rather than throw you in jail, we'll just let you pay the $500 on the meter that's still running, and you can." And we will, no one will ever hear about this. And he wrote that song, Boat Drinks, based on that night hanging out with the Boston Bruins.
That's spectacular. That reminds me of another one in the book. When I talked to Cooper, actually, you know, one of the things I sort of did with these interviews is at the end of every interview, I said, "Hey guys, do you know of anybody else who's a great storyteller?" Because that's all I really want in this book is great storytellers. And when I finished with Coop, he said, "You got to talk to a guy named Eric Nielsen," who I vaguely knew the name, but really didn't know it well. Eric never played in the league, but he was Sidney Crosby's roommate in Rimouski. And he was, and Cooper said he was the craziest guy that he ever coached. And so, and Eric Nielsen's stories gave me the basis of a chapter on Crosby of what it was like to be, you know, Sid's roommate. And Sid had, you know, Sid just loves this guy. And the reason that Sid's nickname to his buddies is Daryl, hardly anybody knows this because everybody calls him Sid the Kid, but there's a bunch of guys in Rimouski that know him only as Daryl, basically because the very first game Sid played in Rimouski, he got 8 points. He had 8 points midway through the third period, and they were thinking about Daryl Sittler, so they started calling him Daryl. And to this day, Eric Nielsen only calls Sid Daryl and nothing else. But basically, Eric Nielsen was out to the bar one night in Sid's rookie season. Sid was at home, and I guess he was the designated driver driving a bunch of drunk teammates home, and he was showing off. And crashed the car in downtown Rimouski. And the cop came, and Nielsen thought he was going to get kicked off the team, and that was going to be the end of him. And the cop said, "I'll let you go, but I need autographed Sidney Crosby cards." And so the cop drives Nielsen home at like 3 o'clock in the morning to the Billets house. He sneaks in, he wakes up Sid, and you know, in his description, Sid is an incredibly heavy sleeper, and Sid admits to this, and basically stuffs these cards in his face and grabs a Sharpie, and Sid signs all these cards, and he goes and gives them to the cops, and he gets off. And I guess in the morning, Sid comes down for breakfast, and there's just marker all over his face, like all over his face. And because what it, like, and Sid they all start laughing, the Billets family, and like, Sid, you better look in the mirror. And Sid just thought he'd been pranked. But what happened was he had no recollection of what had happened the night before. And he just went back to sleep with the Sharpie in his hand and basically, you know, rolled over and wrote all over himself. But yeah, again, those are the things that I think that's part of the best part of hockey is stories like that.
There's a great story in here that I'm going to ask you about that I think epitomizes the whole book. I think it epitomizes the whole league, NHL and professional sports, and particularly hockey. You know, the great things that hockey players have done away from the ice. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of email from people talking about the experience they have from Russ and what he did for them. There's unbelievable stories how Russ has spent so much time with guys who were just fans and no one would give him the time of day. And Russ did. The people were brought to tears. Russ has done the same thing for me in my recovery of addiction and sobriety. I'm over 10 years now and Russ has always been there.
That's for me. Awesome.
Yeah. The story of the butterfly child is just an absolutely moving story that you put in here about this young guy. I want you to talk about it in the names. I choked up when I read the story, but the really amazing thing is all the stories of what guys did for this this young guy. And it's a fantastic story in the way that it talks about hockey players like no other athletes. You even make the point that the mother of this child said, you know, we've met a bunch of athletes, people reached out to this kid, and I want you to talk about it in a sec, James. And she had to admit that hockey players gave them more time than anybody. And tell us about that.
Well, just on that part of it, his name's Jonathan Pitcher. He passed away about 3 years ago now. But yeah, when Jonathan sort of became... What happened was I read an article in the Ottawa Citizen that my sister had sent me about this boy who had wanted to be a sportscaster. And he had this condition that I'd never heard of and most people have never heard of called epidermolysis bullosa, which is basically one of the most uncommon but most painful conditions known to mankind. So essentially you're born and your skin from head to toe blisters constantly. Your skin is like that of a butterfly. It's so fragile. So you could nick up against a wall and your entire body would open up. And in Jonathan, some people have mild cases. In Jonathan's case, he had head to toe. So basically his entire life, he has to be wrapped head to toe in bandages. And every 2 days, his mom has to give him a bath and, you know, and then freshen up the bandages. And we ended up doing I was so touched by him. We brought him down to TSN and really one of those old souls, right? 14 years old at the time and talked to you like a 40-year-old. Incredibly courageous, and he loved hockey, and we had him on the panel and we struck up a friendship and we ended up doing a documentary on him that got seen by a lot of people. And it's hard to watch, but I encourage your listeners to YouTube the Butterfly Child and learn more about Jonathan, because he really was unbelievable. But he got to be, you know, through this documentary and a couple of others that were made about him, he got well known, and, you know, he would go to football games and went to a Raptors game. And what you're saying there, Jim, is that, you know, the athletes would all be super nice to him, but, you know, they'd present the jersey or whatever and be gone.
Right.
Which is, you know, and that's fine. That's the reality of their world. But in hockey, it didn't happen that way. You know, in particular, the Ottawa Senators, you know, Carlson befriended him. Kyle Turris, who's, you know, doesn't have a super rep these days as a hockey player, but he, you know, unbeknownst to anybody, would email this kid and call him on the phone basically every day. And I'm trying to think of the others. Just Sidney Crosby. This is one of the great things that Sid did. And I only found out about this because Sid and I share the same tailor, this guy in Montreal who does a lot of hockey players, and a guy named Dominic. And Dominic told me one day, "Do you ever know what Sid did for this boy, Jonathan?" And I said, "No." So Jonathan wanted to feel like a hockey player. But of course he could never play hockey with his condition. Mm-hmm. And so Sid got a suit tailored for him, you know, because Jonathan always liked when the players walked into the arena at the beginning of the show and how cool they looked in their suits. So Sid got his tailor to make a suit for him that was tailor-made for him. And he wore that suit every time he went to a game. He wore it on the NHL awards show when they invited him on. And he took more pride in that suit than anything else. And again, Sid nobody ever told anyone about this. It was just happened to be my tailor that mentioned it to me. So you're so right, Jimmy. The players really, you know, Kyle Turris's wife told me that Kyle cried for, you know, a day when he found out that Jonathan had passed away. And, yeah, thanks for noticing that chapter, because I did want there to be a few serious things in there. When I read a book myself, I don't read enough. My wife always jokes that I've written more books than I've read, but, I like to be surprised from page to page, right? I don't want it to be all yucks and giggles. I kind of want it to run the gamut of emotions. And, Jonathan's story was very personal to me. So I'm glad it resonated with you.
Yeah, it was, fantastic. The book is called Beauties, by James Duthie, one of the most, awarded, you know, sports anchors and journalists that we've had in this country. And like I said earlier, man, you got to be good if you're going to survive in this business. And, you've put together this book, you know, it's a, grab a seat. It says on the inside flap, you know, grab a seat with TSN's James Duthie as hockey's finest, relive highs, lows, hilarious moments on and off the ice, and stories from superstars, journeymen, coaches, referees, broadcasters, agents, hockey moms and dads. It's called Beauties.
And when they say grab a seat, they mean the toilet seat, because you can read like one chapter and then throw it down. And the next day when you're having, you're doing your business, you can read another one.
Yeah. Makes you take a shit. No.
Yeah. they wouldn't put that on the back cover. That's what I recommend.
Yeah, exactly. It's James, we can't thank you enough for coming on, man. And do yourself a favor, folks, and get a hold of the Beauties. How's it going, by the way? Is it selling? What's going on?
Yeah, no, it's done really, really well. Thank you, guys. And I meant what I said. If Beauties 2 comes around, I'm going to be phoning both of you. So there you go.
I'm sending you a story right now. By the way, the one you brought up with Tucker going into the room, that's what made Pat Quinn so cool. He'd offer a guy a cigar and a scotch.
I know.
As only Russ can, he would get called into the room, but he'd bring the scotch.
After I retired, I played for Pat in Vancouver, and I went to Toronto for some event. And so I went down, watched the game, and I walked right into the room and said, I'm here to see Pat. So I walk in there and was it Rick Lee was his assistant, and Waters was assistant GM at the time. They're all sitting around, and there's Pat having a cigar and a scotch. And then he'd open a can of Coke and just pound like two big sips and be gone. And I sat there for, I don't know how many scotches, but I swear he drank about three Cokes. Pat was just Pat and Serge Savard are my two favorite people in hockey. They're just... Right. Gentlemen, and they cared about their players, and they're honest, and sometimes the honesty was tough to listen to, but you know, they were the type of people that would pick you up when you needed it, put you down when you needed it, and they were 9.9%, 99.9% right every time. They were just great people.
And then James, when you write your next book, you're gonna get a hold of Russ and say, "Tell me how much you admire John Brophy and Pat Burns." Okay,
that'll be my first question.
Yeah. James, thanks a lot, man. I know you're busy. Is the this all Canadian division, James, that we're watching right now? I don't know if it's they thought it would create a bunch of rivalries. I don't know if it's done that.
Well, I think the problem, Jimmy, and I know you got to go and I got to go, but. I think the only problem they might have is if there's no playoff race, right? If right. there's separation between the four that make it and the three that don't, then I don't think it'll be, you know, and that hopefully we'll have at least a race for the fourth spot. But that would be the only problem I would see is you need there to be stuff on the line for it to be super intense. And if that's not the case, then maybe they'll have some issues. But it's been fun.
Okay, we can't let you go because of course Russ is favorite team. That he played for was the Leafs, I guess, Russ. I don't know. Is it your wishy-washy? Is it Montreal? Is it the Leafs?
No, my dad, you know, we grew up watching the Leafs, and my dad was a big Leaf fan. So was I. Boris Salming was my favorite player, and I got drafted there. So, of course, Toronto's my favorite team.
So dare I say, James, that this could be the year for the Leafs? Is this, yeah?
I think that if they... If they can win that first round, then they have a really good chance to do some damage. It's just that mental hurdle of the first round. You know, if they play, let's say, I don't know, if they end up playing McDavid and Draisaitl on the first round, they should beat them because they're deeper all the way around. But you never know when you're playing two guys like that. Or let's say it's Calgary and, you know, the goalie is on fire. That's, you know, you just never know. But
yeah,
if they get out of the Canadian division, I would say that they're going to rock into that Final Four with a ton of confidence.
Remember the Sakic and the Nordiques. They had the same problem. They couldn't win. They got to, you know, then they moved the team and a little older, a little mature, added some veterans.
Boom, cups, yeah.
Yeah. And they won. And it took them a while. They were great early on too. And they just had a tough go the first 2-3 years until they made a few deals. And
the Leafs, you know, they're just dealing with that small nagging pesky issue of not winning a cup in 55 years.
Yeah, it's a little tiny thing.
Little small issue there with the fans, you know, that thing. James, listen, brother, thanks a lot for taking the time. You're one of the busiest guys on the planet. We really appreciate it. Again, the book is called Beauties, and it's 57 stories it's a page turner.
Thanks, boys. I really appreciate it. Always great hearing stories from you guys as well, and all the best.
Thanks.
Thanks, James. Maybe we will write a book, Russ.
Give it away to our friends and family at Christmas. Yeah,
exactly. And then we'll have five copies still left over. You've been listening, of course, to The Suspendables. Thanks a lot to James Duthie. Great. And one of the all-time great guys, by the way. Super wonderful human being. And his book is called Beauty, so go ahead and check it out. We're back again next week. We come at you each and every week with another episode of The Suspendables with me and Russ. And check out our website, suspendables.com, for all the shows that are on there, and like and share and tell everyone about it. And Rusty, did you make it through the whole fucking show without a White Claw?
Yeah, I had it's early here, so I couldn't do it. And we talked about stories today. This reminds me, we've got to get invite my friend on to tell the Pebble Beach.
Oh, yes.
Story. MC. We got to get MC on to tell the story of our golf trip to Pebble Beach and what happened. It's epic.
The teaser is, I don't know, 25,000. Is that the teaser?
Yeah. His cost is about 25K.
Good one. Okay. We'll try and do that next week.
Yeah, we should do it soon, though, because Matt, when are Masters coming up?
Masters is always the first full week in April, you know, COVID aside.
Right.
Last year was in November, but.
Well, we got to get MC on. We don't want to give out his full name because he is a businessman.
Embarrassing.
His friends will know.
Okay, man. Yeah. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you next week with another episode of The Suspendables. Take it easy, everyone. Have a good week. Rusty, get back to doing whatever you're doing.
Okay.
The Suspendables is a weekly podcast series featuring former NHLer Russ Courtnell and host Jim Jerome. Join us for new episodes available each Wednesday morning. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We invite you to subscribe and review or share the show with your friends and followers. Check out our website today, thesuspendables.com.